Welcome to OncoFarm. I'm your host, John Bizarre. I am a professor of pharmacy practice here at the supporting sponsor of OncoFarm, ETSU's Bill Gatton College of Pharmacy. It is the first episode of May here in 2024. We've got one new FDA approval to talk about and a couple other smaller papers, one of which is not that new, but was new to me. And so we'll talk about it. But let's start with the conversion of tisotumab vedotin or Tivdak FDA approval from accelerated approval based on response rate a few years ago to a regular approval now with some overall survival data. First thing I noticed in reviewing this study was the INTOVA TV301 was presented at ESMO in the fall. The updated label has a new warning precaution for severe cutaneous reactions that was not there on the original approval. And the big thing with tisotumab vedotin is there's a lot of eye toxicity. You got to give like a vasoconstrictor. You got to give a corticosteroid. You got to do eye drops. It'd almost be easier to remove the eyes for people on this drug and then put them back in after they're done with therapy. All the precautions you have to go through to try to minimize the ototoxicity of this drug. And this drug is an antibody drug conjugate, as you know by the vedotin. And the target is tissue factor. So you do see hemorrhage, mostly epistaxis in like a third of patients here with tisotumab vedotin. So the pivotal study that got the approval, the regular approval, as I said, is INOVA TV301, which was 500 patients with recurrent or metastatic cervical cancer who had one or two lines of treatment in the recurrent / metastatic setting, including chemotherapy and an immune checkpoint inhibitor. And so these folks are randomized one-to-one to either the 2 mg per kg dose of tisotumab vedotin every 3 weeks or investigator's choice chemo. Most of these folks got gemcitabine. They also could have received topotecan, ivermectin, irinotecan, or pemetrexed. Pemetrexed, 32% got pemetrexed. Gemcitabine, 44%. So pretty much everyone got gem or pemetrexed. There is a modest improvement in overall survival. You know, the median OS is 11.5 months with tisotumab vedotin. Chemo is 9.5 months. An even more modest improvement in progression-free survival, although percentage-wise, it's in line with that. Response rate 18% versus 5%. And when you look at the Kaplan-Meier curves, they separate pretty noticeably and they stay fairly, you know, parallel. So there certainly is an overall survival benefit here. These chemotherapy options seem reasonable. This is, you know, you're now in almost the second or third line setting for metastatic cervical cancer. We don't have a lot of drug options left. So whatever subsequent therapy could be given is unlikely to probably to make a difference in overall survival. So a drug that I don't know, hesitate to say a good drug because it is pretty darn toxic, but certainly a very active drug here. And I'm sure there are studies ongoing to see about moving it up in therapy. That is the nature of things. First, you know, we get the overall survival benefit in kind of the last line setting, and then you study it compared to an earlier standard of care or in addition to an earlier standard of care, depending on the toxicity as it comes up. So that's a notable FDA approval in the last week. I want to talk about, you know, one of the things that really grinds my gears is when there's an obvious question that has not been answered. And that question is, what is the dose of methotrexate we could use for high-dose methotrexate? This comes up every time. We have a patient with high-dose, with primary CNS lymphoma, and what dose of high-dose methotrexate to use? Because there are 3.5 g/m² regimens, there are 8 g/m² regimens, they're never been compared to each other. These regimens are a little bit different in whether or not they say they have temozolomide, or whether or not they have thiotepa, or whatever. So, I just, you know, there is a common sense oncology movement, and I just wish we did some common sense studies of let's figure out the best dose. This is what the ALL cooperative groups did, you know, 50 years ago in treating childhood leukemias. Let's figure out the best dose of these things. Let's do a study just to ask a simple question, what's the best dose, and go from there. And I bring this up because there was a publication in the most recent issue of the Journal of Oncology Pharmacy Practice. Lead author here is Daniel Shrum, or Scrum, S-C-H-R-U-M. This is from a pharmacist at Duke and looks to be their neuro-oncology department. Basically a retrospective review looking at people getting 3.5 g/m² or less, including some folks that only got a gram per meter squared of high-dose methotrexate for primary CNS lymphoma versus patients getting, you know, 8 g/m² or doses above 3.5 grams per meter squared. And, you know, it's like 90 patients, something like that, 92 patients. It's a retrospective, you know, study. So all you can kind of say is, that's interesting. But there doesn't seem to be, you know, it's tough to see that there's huge benefit here. And of course, this is limited by the retrospective nature. But they're asking the right question, and I wish we could do a randomized study to figure out the right dose, because that's kind of our job as pharmacists, is like, what's the best dose here? And it's really hard. We can't answer that question. All we have are honestly educated guesses, and we don't have great evidence with which to make an educated guess, except we feel pretty strong that you need 3.5 grams per meter squared to get adequate blood-brain barrier penetration with methotrexate, because it is really hydrophilic, so it's not going to cross the blood-brain barrier unless you have a super high concentration. All right, the next thing I want to talk about is an old paper, and I guess therefore an old concept, but one that was novel to me and was one that when I learned about it, I was like, oh, that kind of, I should have thought of that. That makes sense. So we have known for years that the use of EGF targeting monoclonal antibodies like cetuximab or panitumumab, you know, work best for those who are BRAF wild type, right? We knew that for, you know, we've known that for almost a decade, I would say. And that was kind of the end of my investigation into that. Now, when we say BRAF wild type, what we're trying to avoid is using a drug that works outside the cell when there is an activating mutation of BRAF inside the cell that's in the same transduction pathway, signal transduction pathway. And usually we're talking about the most common BRAF mutation in colon cancer are BRAF V600 mutations, like BRAF V600E or BRAF V600K. You know, those are the ones that are mutated in half of metastatic melanomas, very, very oncogenic, constitutive activation, really high kinase activity. Well, seems also to reason that there are other BRAF mutations that may or may not confer constitutive activation. So this was something that I just learned of. And so we can people have categorized these as class 1, class 2, and class 3 BRAF mutations. Class 1 is the V600 mutation with really high kinase activity, really great evidence this is an oncogenic driver. There are class 2 mutations. Now these can occur at other, you know, at other points in the protein, and they confer intermediate to high kinase activity. And there are class 3 mutations, and one like D594A is a class 3 mutation. And these confer BRAF activity that is low or even absent, which means it's not actually causing upregulation activity, and therefore targeting EGFR outside the cell may in fact be effective. And this review article here talks about how response is common. Their citation for that is as a, you know, an observational study where 14 of 28 patients responded, 50%. I wouldn't call that common, especially with low numbers, but a new concept that I was unfamiliar of, and especially as we're getting more and more next generation sequencing and liquid biopsy and seeing more and more mutations, we do maybe need to think a little bit more in molecular tumor boards and referring patients to molecular tumor boards to think about, you know, what other options we may have for folks. Now, of course, if you have an absent or you have a BRAF mutation that's class 3 that doesn't confer activity, you know, it seems like maybe there's a good chance there's an NRAS or KRAS mutation that then might actually confer a lack of response to a drug like cetuximab or panitumumab. But I will have that show notes, a link to this in the show notes in case this is new to you, like it was to me, for your own reading and review and fun. Well, that's what I have for this week. Thank you so much for listening. You can follow me on the app formerly known as Twitter at FarmDeetNib, and you can follow the podcast on X, Threads, and Instagram at OncoFarmPod. And until I talk to you again, remember, doses matter.